Today is Wednesday, July the 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. pulled out of the deal, and now signatories to the Iran nuclear agreement express concerns about Tehran's uranium enrichment.
From Iran's point of view, the essential terms of the bargain have been broken, and they are free then to break out as well.
Protests and outrage grow following a report on appalling conditions in facilities holding migrants at the U.S. border. Also ahead, the godmother of Seoul has a street named after her. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the remaining signatories to the 2015 International Pact to Restrain Iran's Nuclear Weapons Development all voiced concern Tuesday that Tehran has exceeded the limit of how much low-enriched uranium it could stockpile. Britain, France, Germany, and the European Union said in a joint statement they'd been inconsistent and clear that their commitment to the nuclear deal depends on full compliance by Iran. And they're urging the Islamic Republic to, quote, refrain from further measures that undermine the accord. President Donald Trump withdrew the United States from the Iran nuclear deal last year. Joining us to discuss this all is Ramesh Thakur, Emeritus Professor at the Australian National University's Crawford School of Public Policy. What is your reaction to the rising tensions and the latest developments with Iran?
Well, there's three stages. One is, I think, the rest of the world, pretty much with the exception of Israel and Saudi Arabia, was greatly disappointed when the U.S. pulled out of the deal, because the rest of the world thinks it was actually a pretty good deal. Second, I think there's a growing resentment and anger at the imposition of secondary sanctions, because the rest of the world tried to protect the deal by ensuring that Iran kept getting some sanctions relief on its part of the bargain in return for observing the limits. And third, most recently, particularly with the 10-minute cancellation of the military strikes, there's growing fear and anxiety at the risk of a war, particularly as all the consequences of that seem to be negative rather than positive. I think it's unrealistic to expect that Iran would continue to maintain its limits and observe the terms of the deal if it wasn't getting a sanctions relief. Let me put it this way. Two examples from beyond the technical terms of the deal. If we were to get the same deal as we had with Iran in 2015, today, with North Korea, we would just jump at that chance. So it's a good way of thinking of how good the deal was. Secondly, if in fact the deal was a sham, why should we be concerned if Iran decides to break out? The fact that we are concerned indicates that, yes, it was. There were some genuine achievements. There was actually a rollback. Now we are talking of a possible freeze and accepting that with the North Koreans. In the Iranian case in 2015, there was a rollback. We dismantled some facilities. We eliminated stockpiles. They had about 10,000 kilograms of low-enriched uranium at the time. And in the deal, they agreed to go down to 300. That's a 98% reduction. Now they've said that they have breached the 300 kilogram limit, and if they don't get relief, if the deal is not restored, then they will also breach the enrichment limit, which is set at 3.6%, 3.67%. They were at just below 20% at the time the deal was temporarily negotiated in 2013, and at 20%, they are very close to the weapon-grade enriched uranium.
Russia and China have blamed the U.S. and its economic sanctions and its maximum pressure campaign on Iran for creating the problem to begin with as far as the rise in tensions. Do you agree?
Yes, because the whole point of that was a quid pro quo. Iran agreed to observe limits and observe international inspections to verify its limits compliance in return for sanctions relief. If the U.S. pulls out and sanctions relief is not forthcoming, from Iran's point of view, the essential terms of the bargain have been broken, and they are free then to break out as well.
President Trump on Monday said he thinks Iran is, quote, playing with fire by breaching the stockpile limit. But as you just mentioned, he pulled out of the deal, so it's sort of confusing as to how you can say someone is breaching something when you pulled out of an agreement and said it was a bad.
And very soon the Trump administration is going to come to a fork in the road where they're either going to have to eat humble pie, if you like, and withdraw from their objections and maybe restore the deal, or they're going to have to go in for military strikes. And as I said, we only see downsides in that. We don't see any upsides in military strikes.
It would seem unlikely that if the U.S. were to use military action against Iran, it would probably not get much support.
It would get very little support. It might have a few cheerleaders in Saudi Arabia and Israel, and one or two others might join, but no, there would be very little support. And that's been made very clear. In response to Americans' calls for maximum pressure on Iran, the Europeans have been using the language of maximum restraint, a language they have used, by the way, with Iran as well. But I don't think anyone expects Iran to stay in compliance indefinitely, because as a result of the secondary sanctions on European and other companies, other countries have not been able to step in and provide economic assistance and sanctions relief. American actions, by the way, are also in violation of the unanimous United Nations Security Council directive to assist in the implementation of the 2015 deal agreement to which the U.S. was party.
All right, that is Ramesh Thakur, Emeritus Professor at the Australian National University's Crawford School of Public Policy. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. House committee files a lawsuit over Trump's tax returns. U.S. downplays Trump's concession to sell chips to China's Huawei telecom firm. American students build schools in Senegal. And a Navy SEAL has been acquitted on murder and killing a captive in Iraq. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Protests against Donald Trump's immigration policies are being held across the U.S. as public outrage grows over the conditions in which thousands of immigrants, some no more than a few months old, are being held by the U.S. government. Photos show detained migrants pleading for help. The images released on Tuesday by U.S. government inspectors who visited facilities in South Texas after crossing the nearby border with Mexico show overcrowded cells and unhealthy conditions. The report quotes one senior government manager as calling the situation a ticking time bomb. AP correspondent Tim McGuire reports.
Demonstrators descended on local congressional offices in a number of cities demanding the same thing. Justin Hugie, protesting outside Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn's Houston office, says people are demanding change.
They have to get involved, they have to get activated, they have to show up.
The Department of Homeland Security's Inspector General, in a report, warns facilities in South Texas are seriously overcrowded, needing immediate attention. The report finds conditions are due to a surge in families crossing the border seeking asylum. I'm Tim McGuire.
A meeting of European leaders suspended a summit they were holding in Brussels. They were struggling. They ended it Monday after struggling with the ability to find common ground on leadership spots. EU leaders were able, though, to fill the bloc's top spots, breaking an extensive deadlock over candidates. And for the first time in European Union history, two of the bloc's most powerful positions will be headed by women, assuming the European Parliament approves their nominations. Still, European leaders suspended an overall summit in Brussels over a top leadership stalemate. Joining us to talk about all of it is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. So, Catherine, is it safe to say there are still quite a few deep divisions that need to be worked out?
There are indeed. It took four meetings for the heads of state or government of the 28 European Union members to agree on these four new proposed posts. So it was a long time in the coming. It definitely did show that the European Union has got a lot of work to do when it comes to finding agreement on who will be the heads of various arms of the European Union and its executive wing. So, yeah, it was really a heavy time. And, in fact, the only one who came out and said this has all been a disaster was the French President Emmanuel Macron, who said, look, this whole process, because there was no process involved, it went on forever, it took lots of wheeling and dealing, he said, it just shows that we've got a long way to go before we're actually on the right road to full European unity. That having been said, though, he did come forward and he did praise the four new propositions for these jobs, which are, of course, you know, two women, two men, and it's the first time in 60 years that there has been an end to that male dominance of the top jobs in the European Union.
But they still haven't filled them all, correct?
Well, they've filled four of them. They've got two, which is the head of the Commission and the head of the European Council. They still need to go and be confirmed by the European Parliament. They've nominated the head of the European Central Bank, Christine Lagarde, who has been the head of the IMF since 2011. She's got to be confirmed by the Eurozone members. Plus, you've also got the their foreign policy chief. He's also got to be confirmed by the European Parliament. So the names are all there. They've just got to be confirmed. But yeah, you know, the next step is to get the European Parliament to confirm them.
What are some of the major positions or issues that are causing so much sort of contention or disagreement or a roadblock to common ground?
The big problem has been that these are all four are all, if you like, people who have been in politics, in government for a long time. They're, none of them are elected to posts within the European Parliament. Remember back in May when the European Parliament had its elections, new members came in, and everyone thought, gosh, of course the whole makeup of the Parliament has changed. It's far more diverse. It's moved away from just the socialists and the conservative blocs. It's now got more populist movement. It's got more Greens. A lot of people thought, hey, this means that now we're going to perhaps have some sort of process whereby the heads of the European Union, various branches, will be chosen from those members of the European Parliament, these elected members. Now, that didn't happen, and that's where the blockage is coming from. You've still got these executives, the heads of state and government of the 28 members saying, no, it will be up to us to decide who gets these jobs, not the elected members of the European Parliament.
If they've halted the whole thing, where do things go from here now?
Well, the next thing is it will go before the European Parliament. It's never happened before that these posts have been rejected, so there's every chance that they could well get through. But certainly, overall, the problem is it's not a good look for the European Union. They have got so much on their plate at the moment that they need to deal with. You've got 28 member states. You've got a population of 512 million, huge trading bloc, and they're up against some of the very defining issues of our generation, and that's going to be migration, disinformation, climate change, trade wars brought on by President Trump. You've got Brexit, Iran, you've got populism, you've got China, all these types of issues that are really changing the way society is working at the moment and the way governance is working. These are issues that have really got to be dealt with, and so the fact that the European Union is, if you like, knocking itself out over summit after summit and backroom deals to get these jobs filled just shows it's not a good look for them.
All right, Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence at the last minute canceled a Tuesday trip to the state of New Hampshire and hurried back to the White House for reasons unknown. The principal deputy White House press secretary told a group of reporters who gathered outside his West Wing office seeking comment, they said that just something came up. Shortly after it happened, White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman spoke with VOA's Jim Bertel about the development, and this was taped on Tuesday.
We're aware of some situation, it's unclear what it is, that has compelled the vice president of the United States to cancel or cut short a trip to New Hampshire and rush back to Washington. The vice president is here in the White House. When we pressed the deputy senior White House press secretary Hogan Gidley about what's going on, whether this is something of a national security nature or a political crisis or something personal, all he would reply is something came up. He says he won't clarify at this time what this involves, but says that there is no cause for concern. And when a group of reporters outside his office said, well, we are concerned, he said there's no cause for it and there's nothing to worry about. The vice president, as of noon Eastern Daylight Time, was back in the White House. It's unclear whether he's meeting with the president. We're also assured that the vice president was not summoned back to Washington because of any problem with the president. And that's about all we know at this moment.
So has there been increased activity at the White House? Anything to indicate something big is going on?
No, I did notice some of the president's personal detail, the Secret Service, just outside the colonnade, meaning that the president's most likely in the Oval Office and that there may be other people in there as well. But we're not on any sort of lockdown here at the White House, and we're not aware of any sort of national security crisis, not even rumors of anything of that nature that have been going around that would indicate any sort of imminent military activity. So it's just a big mystery right now. But of course, this is an unusual situation.
All right. That was VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman speaking to VOA's Jim Bertel. Three regional civil society organizations are suing Uganda and Rwanda over the border closure that's now lasted 4 months. Traders say their goods are stuck in Rwanda, with analysts reporting millions of dollars in revenue decrease for both countries. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
On February 27th, the government of Rwanda closed the border posts of Gatuna Katuna in Kabale District and Chanika in Kisoro District. 4 months later, the border posts are still closed. Three regional civil society organizations, including the Southern and Eastern Africa Trade Information and Negotiations Institute, say they filed a suit on June 21st. The lawsuit asks the court to issue a permanent injunction against the governments of Rwanda and Uganda to keep them from closing the border posts between the countries and ensure the free movement of people and trade. Sheila Kawamara is the executive director of the East African Sub-Regional Support Initiative for the Advancement of Women.
The suit against the two governments is aimed at ensuring that the losses incurred by the business community, the farmers, and the citizens and society at large are audited and the concerned parties are adequately compensated.
Asan Nsimiraho has been doing cross-border business for 10 years, dealing in beans, peas, and cassava flour exported to Rwanda. He says alternative routes offered by Rwanda were also affected by the border closure, such as areas in the Kabale district affiliated to Gatuna-Katuna border post. Asan says they have been denied permission to collect their goods imported into Rwanda.
For the Rwandese side, they were allowed to take their goods back home. But to our side, even when you go to Rwandan Revenue Customs, you can find some bags of beans. They were denied us to take back to our country. So if the government can do something about it, I think they should compensate us.
In June, Rwanda reopened the border and allowed trucks in for just 12 days. The Ministry of Trade and Industries says since the closure in February, Uganda exports to Rwanda are down from $660 million to about $203 million. Rwanda also reports a loss of about $104 million. Amelia Chambade, Uganda's Minister for Trade and Industry, says the government has not responded to the lawsuit as officials discuss what she describes as a complicated matter.
But I'd advise Ugandans also to look for other routes. I know I was advocating for DRC at one point, but now there is now the challenge of Ebola. But Rwanda, there are still talks from the top level. Let us leave it to our principals. Well, we'll negotiate also with our colleagues, the ministers.
Gatuna-Katuna border post has historically been the major crossing point for cargo trucks and cross-border trade, both formal and informal, heading to Rwanda, Burundi, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Currently, trucks allowed into Rwanda are only those for transit goods to Burundi and the DRC. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
On our voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices
with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
VOA's International Edition continues. In the United States, the Everglades National Park has been on the UN World Heritage in Danger list since 2010. UNESCO is meeting this week and expected to keep the troubled wetland on that list despite decades of restoration efforts. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
This is one of the longtime inhabitants of the Florida Everglades. It lives in this 64,000-hectare wetland, which covers much of the far southern parts of Florida. But these days, things are not well with the Everglades.
The Everglades ecosystem was once huge, and over the years, as Florida has developed, we have cut away not only at the natural wildlife habitat, but also at the water flow. About 70% of the historic River of Grass water flow has been cut off because of Florida's urban and agricultural development. So the downstream Everglades National Park ecosystem has really suffered.
That threatened status of the Everglades prompted the United Nations to put the wetlands on its list of World Heritage and Danger Sites in 2010. A status they're expected to renew in meetings this week.
And so this designation is really the result of many decades of impacts for the Everglades, but it's also coming at a time where we're working very hard to improve the quality of the ecosystem and restore some of what's been lost.
Environmentalist Kara Capps says the Everglades relies on moving water to stay healthy, and for over a century, humans have been channeling that water flow.
About 100 years ago, people sought to change the flow of the Everglades, to dry up the land south of Lake Okeechobee, to make room for development and for agriculture, and they were very good at removing the water. And so now the natural Everglades flow is largely cut off.
And cutting off that water has put pressure on the park and the animals that make it their home.
And in particular, we used to have flamingos, roseate spoonbills, ibis, wood stork, and many of these species are still here, but in dwindling numbers compared to where they were historically. And we often look to the wading birds as an indicator of how we're doing with restoration.
Climate change and invasive species are also pressuring the region, but the problem can be solved.
So we have a plan to restore the Everglades. It's the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan. It was a bipartisan legislation authorized back in 2000, and the program has been chronically underfunded.
The most recent federal budget only provides about one-third of the money needed to fully implement efforts to revive the wetlands. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Legendary soul singer Patti LaBelle now has her own street in her name in the town, in her hometown of Philadelphia. A stretch of Broad Street was renamed Patti LaBelle Way during a ceremony Tuesday. And christening the event, she sang an impromptu song. LaBelle thanked throngs of fans who packed the intersection for the ceremony. And by the way, LaBelle's first number one hit was Lady Marmalade. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. Yeah.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At the U.S.-Africa summit in Maputo, Mozambique, U.S. officials outlined the goals and parameters of a key component of the U.S. government's Africa strategy. Prosper Africa, USAID Administrator Mark Green explained on June 19th, is a new approach, a new framework, a framework that seeks to liberate and mobilize private enterprise. He added, "I believe it gives us an opportunity to double two-way trade and investment in the years ahead." Prosper Africa is a coordinated, whole-of-government approach that harnesses U.S. foreign assistance tools in ways aimed at promoting stability, good governance, and an enterprise-friendly, enabling environment. Pointing to the economic successes of South Korea and India, among others, Administrator Green said, "Private enterprise is the single most powerful force on Earth, lifting lives and building community. In terms of creating sustainable opportunities for rising young Africans, nothing else comes close," he declared. Prosper Africa will be demand-driven and private sector-led. It will align the tools of the public sector to leverage the innovation, resources, knowledge, and networks of our private sector, said Ambassador Green. Among other lines of effort, Prosper Africa, he explained, will facilitate transaction by providing blended finance, loan guarantees, market intelligence, advocacy, and a range of services to de-risk investments. It will develop and deepen markets by tapping into local ventures to provide matchmaking services with U.S. companies and African supply and value chain departments. And it will level the playing field for U.S. businesses by identifying and removing policy, regulatory, and logistical trade barriers in ways that increase transparency and lower the cost of doing business in Africa. Administrator Green noted that the mission of USAID is to foster the journey to self-reliance. Prosper Africa will help break the debt trap that authoritarian funders have planted like landmines in too many parts of this continent, he said. Prosper Africa creates options and alternatives for African leaders who are seeking just a little bit of help with their plans for the future. It will help Africans seize the power of investment and enterprise, and it will accelerate their journey to self-reliance.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VO.